Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Money Tree Investing Podcast. I'm Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacking Benjamins, driving the bus today. And I'm really excited because it's a special episode, one of my favorite episodes, where we're answering your questions. And here is our esteemed panel of question answerers. We'll start out in the desert with Linda P. Jones. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you. I'm so excited. We had a 90-degree day yesterday. Only 90 degrees. It's getting cooler and fall is coming. I'm excited.
The frog's only a little boiled now.
Yeah. My dog got to go outside for the first time in a couple months. It's pretty sad.
Yeah. It was funny when I moved from Michigan to Texas, just as a quick aside, I know this isn't what the show's about, but I used to say goodbye to my neighbors in, you know, November, December. And it would, when you'd look outside your window, it clearly looked like you didn't want to be out there until maybe March or April. Then you go out in your front yard and you'd say hello to your neighbors again. When I moved to Texas, it was exactly the opposite. May came around and I'd say goodbye to my neighbors. But the thing that drives me crazy, and this has got to be the same for you, Linda, I look outside and it looks gorgeous. And I take two steps outside my door and I go, what the hell were you thinking? And run right back inside.
Oh, it's such a hot oven. I mean, it just doesn't cool down under 100 at night. It's just crazy.
Yeah. But then in December and January, how happy are we?
Yeah, exactly. Well, 8 months of beautiful, beautiful weather.
Amen. And here's a guy who's happy all the time. Also, I think in the desert where he lives, Doug Goldstein, do you live in the desert?
Well, it used to be the desert. Israel was then replanted about 60 years ago and is really cool. Actually, the neat thing about Israel is that pretty much any time of year, it's a kind of small country. In fact, Israel's smaller than New Jersey. I don't know if I'm embarrassed to say that, but you can just go to the other side of the country in a couple of hours and either be in the desert or at the beach or in, you know, skiing on the Hermon Mountain.
Fantastic. And not in the desert, I think, in Idaho, although there's some weird stuff in Idaho. And I'm not even talking about the geography. It's because Miranda Markwood is there.
Yeah, I'm weird. I'm weird up in here, and that is no joke. No, actually, we are. We're here on the Snake River Plain, and we're considered the high desert. So, yay.
Yeah.
Here we go. Let's do this. Listener questions.
Welcome to the Money Tree Geography Podcast. My name is Joe. Let's dig into these because we've got some great ones. Our first question here comes from our friend Shiloh. Shiloh says, just discovered the show. Welcome, Shiloh. And has been listening to episode after episode. I really have been enjoying this since I discovered it. I'm 28 years old and have made a few mistakes in my life, and I'm now stuck in a job that doesn't exactly pay well. I pretty much live paycheck to paycheck, but have been trying to learn about investing. I opened an Acorns account and a Robinhood account because they really have no barrier to entry and have had some growth, 5.3% in Acorns and 7.7% in Robinhood so far. Though I'm writing this the day after the Brexit vote, which, by the way, shows how far behind we are on letters, guys, writing this the day after the Brexit vote, so it's dropped a bit. While you guys are great and have helped me understand investments to an extent, I want to learn more, and you may be a bit too advanced for me, but all the resources I found seem to be too expensive. Are you aware of any low-cost resources to help someone living on a budget learn more? What do you feel is the best way to get involved in the market if a person doesn't have a spare $1,000 or so? Thanks so much for all the help you've already provided. I've enjoyed the show and look forward to listening to your upcoming episodes. Well, thanks, Shiloh. And Miranda, let's start with you. What's your favorite resource that's a low-cost barrier to entry?
So I really enjoy, if you have $100 a month, as we know, I really enjoy Betterment. They are not sponsoring the show. They are not paying me to say this, but I really enjoy Betterment because it is a pretty low barrier to entry and they help you with a portfolio that is comprised of index ETFs, which helps you with instant diversification, even though you don't have a lot of money and you don't have a lot of effort in the market. If you don't have $100 a month and you can't do the Betterment thing, I actually think Acorns has kind of some high fees and Robinhood.io kind of encourages more trading than you should probably do. But if you can...
Why? Because it's free?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people kind of get that idea that it's, you know, since it's free, they can just trade. But they're not bad places to start because you do get, you know, access. And like she said, it's a low barrier to entry. If you can find an index ETF, they trade like stocks on Acorns or Robinhood, I think those would be great places to start. And then read some books. There are plenty of books out there that aren't very expensive. Benjamin Graham has a great book. John Bogle, he's the founder of indexing. So these are some great books that are pretty low cost. You can get them, pretty low cost and start learning a little bit more.
Doug, how about you? What are your favorite resources for somebody just starting out?
So I think the question, just to clarify the question, is just where to learn stuff, right? It wasn't so much a question as how to invest with low fees, because
that's
just a different question.
Well, no, he asked about low-cost resources.
Right.
I wasn't paying attention at that point. But I was paying attention about the educational stuff. Listen, I'm a big fan of the books. I'm also, this is not related to finance, but if you are into reading books for free, you can download an app called Overdrive, and it gives you access to your local library's ebooks for free. So you don't even have to spend the gas going over to the library to get a book, because if you sign up, you can get all these great informational books from your local library. There are also super blogs, not the least of which is the Rich as a King blog, which I write. And I think that all of us actually produce various materials that are designed for the general population, not like super technical. So I appreciate, Shiloh, that you thought that we were all too advanced. But I think that everyone on the panel here really does try on their own websites to share ideas that are really meant for everyone to get.
I have to, because I'm so not advanced myself.
I would disagree with that, but I like your style where you keep it very simple, Miranda. I think you're way more advanced than you let on. I think that's your shtick.
Oh, dear. Joe's on to me.
Linda, we can't leave you out of this. What are your favorite low-cost resources?
Well, here's the thing. He's already in Acorns. He's already doing Robinhood, which, by the way, he didn't say what his time frame was that he got those returns. But seeing how the market's only up about 4% year to date, I think that's pretty darn good. So if he's done that, in a 6-month period or a 3-month period, that's amazing. I would have to say, I think where he is in just getting started building wealth. I have 6 steps to wealth that I talk about. The first one is to create a wealthy mindset, so you can always work on your positivity and thinking about what's possible, thinking bigger. But it sounds to me like you're really on step 2, which is saving a nest egg. So I think for you, I would focus on saving more money, maybe dollar cost averaging into something you can generally dollar cost average for maybe as little as $25 a month into, even a Standard & Poor's 500 type of ETF or mutual fund would be something that you could get started on. It's just a basic part of your asset allocation, but you really need to focus on saving your nest egg and getting your capital together to invest.
Great stuff from all of you. My favorite, I'm just going to give a quick shout out to add just a little more fuel to this fire. I love the book, The Truth About Money by Rick Edelman, because even though it's a thick book, it's really funny. It has a lot of photographs, a lot of diagrams, a lot of quick explanations. As an example, one of the things that made me laugh out loud, he's going through some rule about investing, and he says, and on the next page, I'll tell you exactly why that rule came about in the first place. And you turn the page and he says, nobody really knows, but that's not the point. And I find myself really doing, I find myself page turning a book about financial planning because it's even handed and it's funny. And that's the icing on the cake. I need to get moving. So The Truth About Money is my favorite. Thanks for the question, Shiloh. Let's move on to our next question, which comes to us from Christopher. Christopher says, hello, I'm 26 years old, new to investing, and started listening to the podcast a couple months ago. Welcome to the party, Christopher. I'm trying to listen to all the podcast episodes because each one is a bit of knowledge I didn't have before, even if it doesn't apply to me. I started out at the beginning of last year trying to learn about investing. I asked everyone I knew around me and everyone at work what they knew, and nobody knew anything. Been at my job for 5 years, and I have a 401k from work. They offer a 3% match if you invest 6%, which turns out to be $150. So $100 for my check and $50 match. I recently moved around my investments in my 401k, and my coworker saw me reallocate my investments and asked me to make their 401k match mine. So now I need help knowing if my 401k is diversified enough or too much. I'm worried because it's not just my own money in future, but my coworkers as well. They trust me because they know I wouldn't go out and try to ruin my own future. I think I have to stop there, actually, before we move on to the question, because Linda, somebody else doing something at work is a bad reason for you to do it.
Exactly. You don't want to follow someone else. They could be a different age. They could have different needs. They could be married with kids and you're not. And, you know, the thing is, if you have so many numbers of years, you're going to be looking for growth and so on. So if you're about the same age, maybe you have similar growth prospects. But it's better to get your own information and make your own decisions. But what I like is that he's, you know, working on that. He's maxing out, it sounds like, his 401k. And I think that's a very valuable thing to do.
Yeah. The other problem, Doug, is, and I'm sure you've seen this when you've been working with clients, is somebody hears something from someone at work where they say something like, I made a lot of money in this, which makes people immediately think I should do it too. But what they don't realize is I made a lot of money in this doesn't mean you're going to make a lot of money in the future.
Right. And people have a tendency to only talk about the things in which they had success. And they'll never tell you, you know, something, last week I lost money on 7 of my positions. They'll only tell you about the one that they made a lot of money on. What I usually tell people is, I mean, I'll often just tell clients who are thinking of managing their own money, I'll say, no problem. By the way, if one of your coworkers were to ask you to manage money for him or her, what would you say? And then they go, no, I wouldn't do that. I have no expertise.
You're right, right.
So, right. Really? So you're going to manage your own money? Right. Better hurt your coworker, but you don't want to ruin your own future.
The thing that I'll just add is that, Christopher, companies have ERISA requirements to educate people on their plans. And I think that having some investor education sessions, the companies that provide these all have departments of people that go out. I used to be a person that would go out to companies and talk about how to use your 401k. And it wasn't a sales pitch. It was how to use your 401k better. And my job, obviously, as somebody that represented the people that were putting on the 401k, was to get people to use it more and realize what an opportunity it was. So at the very least, I'd ask your company to provide a little bit of that value. And the good news is that would be free to you. So back to Christopher's question, he says, so here's how he set up his and 5 of his coworkers, 20%.
He's managing money for everyone else at work. They're like, all right, Christopher, what do we do now? You know, buy this fund.
Christopher, charge a fee. Charge a fee, Christopher. But get your license first. The Vanguard 500 Index, which is a large company stocks, that'll be 20%. 25% to the Vanguard Growth Index, that'll be large company growth stocks, 15% into the Vanguard Mid-Size Company Index, 10% into the Vanguard Small Company Index, and then 30% into the Total International Stock Index. He says he doesn't have any bonds, but well, actually, before we get to the bond question, Doug, I don't think we should comment on the actual funds, but let's talk about that allocation. What do you think about that stock allocation?
Yeah, listen, the principle of having a broadly diversified portfolio, which is more heavily weighted in large cap, a lot of people do that because they just say, listen, large cap companies are large for a reason. They've been around. They'll probably be around tomorrow. The one thing that kind of stands out to me is these days, I think having a more globally diversified portfolio is something you got to look into and to decide whether I didn't quite catch what percent you said was global.
30.
It sounded
30.
30. Okay, the question is just whether you feel comfortable with that level, or maybe in this day and age, you'd really want to consider more exposure, just because I'm a big fan of the U.S., but it's not the only economy in the world.
Linda, would some back testing on these funds, looking at 10-year returns versus the risk, help out Christopher?
I'm not a big fan of looking in the rearview mirror. I think one thing that he might consider is sort of a core satellite approach. And that is that he's got really a good core set up where he's got the basics covered in his asset allocation. Now he might want some satellite offerings to pepper in there just in small percentages to maybe, you know, give it a little boost. Certainly REITs have done extremely well in the last 15 years. They might be at the end of that cycle, so beware of that. But that's something that, you know, can provide a little bit of dividend income as well. He might consider a little position in precious metals, which have been doing extremely well this year. So I think putting in some satellites might help to spice up his core.
Interesting. That'll also create a little more volatility, though, don't you think?
It can, but because he's so diversified, I think that also reduces the risk.
Yeah, that's interesting. Just the fact that you can, because I love this idea, and this might be a whole different podcast, you can add spicier stuff to your mix, and it'll still calm down your portfolio.
That's true.
Yeah, good stuff. To continue with Christopher's question, he says he doesn't have any bonds because he likes the Dave Ramsey idea of just keeping it all in stocks. Plus, he knows he's young, so if he does change his mind, he has plenty of time down the road. 100% stocks. Linda, what do you think of that?
Well, he sounds young. I don't know his age, but he sounds to me to be somewhere in his 20s or early 30s.
Oh, he said 26, actually. Oh, yep, 26. Going okay. Back up.
Thank you. So to me, he probably is, it's appropriate for him probably to have that much in stock. I don't know anything about Dave Ramsey's recommendation, but I will say we have talked on the show about the fact that the last 30 years in bonds cannot be reproduced going forward because interest rates are now at their all-time lows. So we're not going to have that tailwind that we've had from bonds. So I can see where, you know, you may want to avoid having bonds in your portfolio. I don't think that's a bad idea for him.
Mr. Certified Financial Planner, do you agree?
Well, I like the fact that he says he knows he's young.
Yeah.
I think I like, you know, he's got his facts in play. I know I'm young. I know I'm young too. Right. I don't have a problem in principle with going heavy in stocks. And, you know, if it's okay if you have the tolerance for risk. If you know you can lose it and, you know, and it may not work out and you're willing to hold on through the ups and downs and absolutely positively there are going to be ups and downs. That's the way the system works. As long as you're not going to let your emotions take over, or if you're married and your wife says, oh my God, you just lost all of our wedding gifts. You better to sell while you can preserve some of it. If you're not in that state, then being a long-term stock investor with a huge allocation to stocks could work for you, but just understand the risk you're exposing yourself to.
Yeah, all investments have a time frame affiliated with kind of best use of that investment, right? So I think if his investment, Doug, were, if you were telling us it were investment for next year, this would be absolutely horrible.
I'm with you.
Yeah. He said he also started a personal investment outside of his 401k. He started with Betterment and Acorns in 2015 in January. He loves the idea of Acorns, but felt the fees were high for the little money he has invested in it. So he pulled his money in December 2015 and put it all just in Betterment. Well, on Monday of the week that he wrote this, he was listening to one of our episodes, and we said that he should try on his own to get experience and decided to pull his money from Betterment so he could set up a Vanguard ETF brokerage and cut the 0.35 fee from Betterment. Plus, he could get the benefit of picking the ETFs he want, watch it fail or succeed, but gain some knowledge. His mentality is to keep and sit on the ETFs he picks. He doesn't want to sell when they're high or low because he's in it for the long haul. He doesn't want to invest in individual stocks because he doesn't know that much, yet also doesn't have that much. He wants to invest his $4,000 that he pulled from Betterment. Thank God he didn't lose money. He gained $15, but at least he didn't lose anything because of what happened with the Brexit issue. He wants to split the $4,000 into six different ETFs. His question, would that be too diverse or just right for what he knows? He knows that we've said to keep the portfolio at 15 to 20 stocks, but how many ETFs are too much? Doug, I guess he's got that question. I also want to go back up what he's saying about fees there too. I'd love to tackle that also, but pick any part of that and give Chris some help.
Sure. I think the number of ETFs, six sounds fine to me. You can do a fantastic job by using six. In fact, even the professional money managers that I work with who usually manage portfolios of ETFs, they'll have maximum 10, maybe 12 if there's something special going on. But I don't have any problem if we're just talking about the question of can you diversify. Six ETFs is fine. The main thing to make sure, though, is that you're not buying only capitalization-weighted index funds, because capitalization-weighted index funds means usually that just a few stocks inside the fund have a disproportionate amount of sway about how the index will do. So make sure you're looking at equally weighted funds, or if not, at least you know that you're not buying equally weighted funds.
Yeah, so you might be buying 500 companies in the ETF, but a huge part of it might just be Apple, is what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And I think most people, that's a great point. Most people don't know that. Linda, six ETFs?
Well, I was going to tackle the fee part of that.
Yeah, go ahead, because I want to jump on that part too.
Because I think Doug already covered that well. So the fee part of it, you know, it's fine to minimize fees. I'm all for Vanguard. I think that's a smart way to invest. I just would caution, don't only invest based on fees. I think you need to look at who is a strong performer and who's outperforming the markets on a consistent basis. And that's really what you want to go with, because it's really the compounding that's going to build your wealth. And yes, saving on fees is going to help a little bit. It might help 35 basis points here or 0.5% there or whatever. And that can add up over time, but not as much as somebody who's outperforming by 1-3% a year and getting you extra performance, which they call alpha, over and above what the stock market average earns. And that extra alpha is what's going to compound for you and build your wealth. So I think just don't be too fee conscious.
Yeah. I mean, to put this in perspective, if I did my math right, I'm $4,000. He cut his fees by $14. And you know what? You're not going to retire or not retire because of the fact that you cut $14 in fees from your portfolio. And I don't want to be flippant about that, but when we've interviewed successful, really uber successful investors in the past, outside of John Bogle, who owns a company that's all about low cost. Now, certainly Vanguard funds have good performance too. It seems like everybody else that we talked to, well, on the Stacking Benjamin show, I interviewed a guy, Magnus Agenfeld, who talks about all the top investors through history, and not one of them mentioned fees as a result of their success. So low-cost investing certainly is a way to make sure that you get solid returns, but to be a successful investor, I think that's not the, I think that's like dragon number three. Would you agree with that, Linda?
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
Yeah, Doug?
Yeah, I'm going to go with something the great Linda P. Jones once said, which is that the wealthy people that she knows and works with are not wealthy because they bought everything on sale or clipped coupons. It's because they found ways to actually make money.
Yeah. Yeah. That Linda P. Jones, she's smart.
She is.
Yes.
I wish I knew her.
The other thing, I actually think that having six funds is way too many for you. And it's only because you're starting with $4,000. And actually, I wish that Miranda were here because I'm actually going to cut on Betterment, not because of the fact that I don't like Betterment, but because I think their advertising is wrong. Betterment advertises to 26-year-olds who have $4,000. And how many different funds are in Betterment? I'm going to get this number wrong, but it's something like 16, 15, you know, different funds. Well, even with six funds, Christopher's going to have $666 in each investment of those six. And if there's a fee to buy the six, going with fees, I don't understand that level of diversification with $4,000. I would buy a total stock market fund with my $4,000, have one ETF, and grow your portfolio, and then make the portfolio more diversified with more positions as you grow the portfolio. Because the number one thing you can do for yourself, Christopher, I think, with $4,000 is continue to save more money aggressively. Your return and your super diversification becomes more and more important the bigger that portfolio gets. But for now, the number one driver is you putting money in. Doug, thoughts about that?
It's funny, I was just thinking, that's exactly what I wanted to say, which is, you know, the guys who talk about, you know, they tell these stories, I retired when I was 35. The way they did it is that they saved 70% of what they were earning.
Right.
So that's the only way you're going to do it. There's no way to build huge wealth without some sacrifice now.
Yeah, great questions, Christopher. And I'm not cutting on what you're saying, because everybody does this. I see it all the time. I don't understand why Betterment isn't advertising to 50-year-olds, because a 50-year-old with a, you know, monster portfolio, then I think we talk about the tax loss harvesting. When I hear about Betterment talking about tax loss harvesting on $4,000, I kind of roll my eyes. Next question comes to us from Michael. Michael says he loves the podcast we put out on a weekly basis. Thank you, Michael. And by the way, this is another opportunity for us to give a great shout out to our engineer, Steve, who really puts this out on a weekly basis.
Hey, Steve.
Yes. Hey, Steve. Steve does a great job. He makes sure that we are regular.
Oh boy, there's all kinds of jokes I could say about that.
Yeah, Linda, that came out wrong. I apologize. Michael has a lot of time because he's listened to all 93 of our episodes, and he can't tell us enough how much he's learned from all of our content. Well, thank you, Michael. That's nice. Michael was wondering if we could suggest a topic we could possibly dive into, which is, what are our thoughts about turnkey real estate investing as a buy and hold investment? We've talked about real estate a few times. I know, has the Jason Hartman episode come out yet? I think it has.
Yes, it has.
Yes.
And then I'm racking my brain for other buy and hold people we've had Eugene Romero on. That was a while ago.
We had if he's listened to all 93, then he's heard.
No, he knows.
Then he knows. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
First of all, I think he should win an award for listening to every podcast. I don't know how many people have listened to every one of our podcasts, but I think we should have a special award for people who have listened to them all.
That's right. A firm pat on the back to Michael. But you know what? Maybe one of the Bigger Pockets guys we could have on. That's a great suggestion, Michael.
That would be good.
Yeah. They're great.
Did he ask us to bring someone on or just wanted to know our thoughts on it? Because I have thoughts on it.
Oh, well, let's do both.
He didn't say to bring someone
on. Let's do both. I'll try to get Josh or Brandon on from Bigger Pockets to talk more about turnkey buy and hold real estate investing. But Doug, your thoughts?
I am not a big fan of these sort of programs, which I find to be a little more complicated than they need to be. And I think that normal investors have no idea what they're getting into when they go into some of these deals. Therefore, I much prefer to go with REITs or REIT ETFs or REIT funds. REIT stands for Real Estate Investment Trust. I think there's more oversight to it. They're much more liquid. You buy and sell them like a stock. They do trade as stocks on the stock exchange, so you can get in and out, and you're in the same industry. You're in the real estate industry. The one thing you're usually not when you buy a REIT compared to a lot of these turnkey real estate investing programs is a REIT is normally not going to be leveraged, and whereas these other real estate deals are. But earlier in today's show, we quoted Dave Ramsey, who says, don't buy anything with leverage. Don't buy real estate with leverage. There is a real school of thought that says that leverage can be a problem for you. And so if you want to avoid that problem and still want to be in real estate, there are other tools which I think are liquid and still in the same industry.
And maybe we should define just briefly here, because a lot of people, Doug, I realized during your explanation of what you don't like about some of the turnkey real estate programs, some people listening might not even know what you're talking about, because it isn't just buying real estate that you're talking about.
I am talking about, maybe I should make sure we're all talking about the same thing. I'm talking about these, I mean, I see these come across my desk. People say we're buying, you know, I get a contacted by some salesman who says, we're buying four buildings and you can get a piece of the action and you can sell it to your clients. And usually they offer very high commissions to the advisors, so which already is a red flag to me. And those are deals that I worry about.
Yeah. And even...
So, is that what you mean by... Are we talking about the same thing?
Well, it's funny that I had misinterpreted Michael's question. And when you... As you were answering, I realized you were answering his question correctly and I wasn't. But I still think the Bigger Pockets guys would have some definite opinions on this type of real estate investing. Linda, do you have thoughts about it?
I don't have any particular thoughts about this, but I do want to comment on the no leverage thing. This blows my mind because I think we've gotten so out of whack on this no debt, no leverage thing, and it's really not good for people because I understand why 18% credit card debt is not good and you don't want to have that for sure. Totally agree there. But why is it so bad to borrow money at 3% or 4%? I don't understand why that is a problem. I think if you can borrow money at 3 or 4%, you should do it and borrow as much as you can for the right reason for an appreciating asset, and that it definitely increases your rate of return. It can definitely, I mean, I've talked about that before, but if you're paying cash for a $100,000 property, it goes up 10%. You've made a 10% return, but if you put 10% down and borrowed 90% and it goes up 10%, you've made 100% return. And it's all about compounding and wealth building. So I just don't understand this whole idea that debt is bad. It's not bad. It's bad for buying things that are depreciating or for the wrong reasons, but for the right reasons, it's how you're going to build wealth. And people are going to have a difficult time building wealth if they don't take a mortgage on their house, if they try to pay for their house in cash, their retirement, and their kids' college at the same time. Are you kidding me? How are they going to fund all three of those? I just think it's absurd.
Okay. Is it time for rebuttal?
Just go ahead and rebut.
Sam's fighting words, Linda. Listen, obviously, you're right. You're 100% right if what you said actually happens. If you borrow money for 4% and you have an asset that appreciates at 5%, so for sure you're making money on money. But just talk to the millions and millions of people, especially older people who were the worst hurt, who lost everything and then some in 2007, 2008. It literally was the end of the world for them, and they lost their last penny. And the simple principle you're describing is absolutely true. It just, real life doesn't always work out that way, not the least of which is when someone goes in to borrow money, he's often going to end up being encouraged or cajoled to buy an adjustable rate mortgage instead of a fixed rate. And when rates start to go up, he will not be able to pay the monthly payments, and he's going to be kicked out again, leading to another crash that's bad for all of us.
Well, I think that had to be that they were buying at the peak and they were overpaying in order for them to be underwater, number one. And number two, I don't think that they need to leverage to the max. I think that there is a smarter way to be leveraged in this economy. And I think you do need to pay more down. Probably a 30% down payment makes a lot more sense in this economy, since we may be in another real estate bubble. So I totally get that. But I still think if you're buying for the long term and you're buying real estate and you're not buying and paying exorbitant prices at the peak, it will work out in your favor.
She sounds so reasonable. Reasonable sounding voice. Oh yeah, well, just don't overpay. Well, how do you know you're overpaying? That's the whole point of no one knows when a bubble is happening. We all talk about it, but how many times have we said, oh, this is a bubble, and it turned out something wasn't? People just don't know. And the idea of not leveraging to the max, again, it sounds so reasonable when you say that, but if you're telling someone you can make 100% on your money by instead of 10% by borrowing X number of dollars, so then surely if you borrow 2X, you'll make 200% on your money. So it's a slippery slope. I actually think the answer is, I'm not against borrowing money, you know, across the board, but I think you have to understand that it's exposing you to different levels of risk. And the problem is, just like with every investment advertisement, you know, people see you know, their eyes start rolling in their head when they see all the amount of money they can make if they use leverage, and they just don't get that leverage actually means there is more risk because you're playing with someone else's money that you ultimately owe the money.
You know what's funny is that last week I talked about the book The E-Myth during our show, and I think that same lesson that we talked about last week from The E-Myth applies, which is, I mentioned this analogy of a woman who is fantastic at baking cakes. And because she's a master, she does things exactly the same every time. She knows the process A to Z first to bake the cake. And the reason she's a master cake maker is because now that she knows the basics, she can go in and take ingredients out and replace some with other ingredients, so she knows when she's breaking the rules. I think this is the same thing, guys. I think that it's degrees of knowing what you're doing. So I think first people have to appreciate the simplicity of an all cash lifestyle and work their budget so they're not living behind the eight ball. Because you read the statistics, so many people, not just in the United States, but around the world, are living on next month's paycheck. And once you realize the all cash lifestyle and you understand then when you're breaking that rule to take leverage, then I think you're much more effective with the leverage because of the fact that you appreciate the risk that you're taking when you have that leverage. Would you say that's fair, Linda?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Because I really appreciate leverage, and I also get frustrated when people are just all cash all the time. I feel like we can graduate from that, right? That Dave Ramsey and Susie Orman, with their healthy respect for a dollar and not owing people money, is fine. But you're right. I think you got to work at trying to get ahead faster.
Of course, they are richer than all three of us combined, four of us combined.
That's right. Right. But they didn't get rich from living an all cash lifestyle. They got rich from owning a business empire. And that's what's funny. I mean, the difference between what Dave Ramsey says and how he got rich, Dave Ramsey didn't get rich following Dave Ramsey's rules. Dave Ramsey got rich by selling a ton of books and giving a lot of speeches and stuff.
And so did Susie.
And so did Susie. Amen. I think that's a good place to leave it because...
I think so too.
Let's pick it up next time. I got more to say.
I know.
Let it go. Let it go.
We're going to leave Doug frustrated for an entire week here. Doug, we'll have you go first then. What's happening at the Goldstein on Gelt show, Rich as a King podcast, the Goldstein Empire?
I just wrote a piece that is in honor of you, Joe, and Linda, the two of you. It's called Why Too Much Confidence Can Make You Lose Money. So check it out at the richasaking.com website at the blog button there. Maybe we'll talk about that sometime.
Awesome. Cool. And how about a Be Wealthy and Smart, Linda?
Well, I think if people are interested in following on the conversation that we just had, they should check out podcast number 176, How to Determine Assets for Asset Allocation.
All right. Awesome. And we'll link to that also in the show notes. At the Stacking Benjamin show, I don't know if you guys know this, but September has been the life insurance Awareness Month. Doug, did you know it was Life Insurance Awareness Month? Happy Life Insurance Awareness Month.
I did not know that.
I wonder who sponsored that.
I know. Linda, do you have balloons at your house? Send everybody a life insurance awareness card.
Wow, I don't.
But JJ Montanaro, who's a great speaker and a fun guy with USAA, is going to talk about how not to buy insurance, but how to protect yourself, right? So sometimes it involves insurance, sometimes it might not. And so we've got JJ Montanaro coming on the show to talk about that.
Good.
Very cool.
So that's it. I got to try to do my best, Miranda, and I'm sure I'm going to mess this up. But thanks for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast, everybody. You'll find our show notes at moneytreepodcast.com. You can also ask us questions there for our letters episodes. Please also leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you listen, because that helps us find new listeners. And if we find new listeners, then we can continue podcasting. That sounded overly. We're not going to podcast if we don't find new listeners. but I think everybody knows what we mean. What's our line, Doug?
No one cares more about your money than you do.
Thank you, Doug.
No one cares more about your money, Joe, than you do. So invest in your life. What about your ex?
Your ex?
Don't they care more about your money?
Your ex might care as much about your money.
Oh, I thought you were saying invest in your ex.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.